DiscerningHearts.com presents The Way of Life, Reflections on the Teachings of St. John Paul II with Dr. Carson Holloway. Dr. Holloway is an assistant professor of political science at the University of Nebraska at Omaha and a former William E. Simon Visiting Fellow in Princeton University's James Madison Program in American Ideals and Institutions. He's the author of Magnanimity and Statesmanship, The Right Darwin, Evolution, Religion, and the Future of Democracy, All Shook Up, Music, Passion, and Politics, and The Way of Life, John Paul II and the Challenge of Liberal Modernity, the book on which this program is based. The Way of Life, Reflections on the Teachings of St. John Paul II with Dr. Carson Holloway. I'm your host, Chris McGregor. Welcome back, Dr. Holloway.
Thanks for having me back, Chris.
It is a fascinating journey we're taking through your book, The Way of Life, John Paul II and the Challenge of Liberal Modernity. It is an exploration of John Paul II's answer to the culture of death, essentially, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. It is, and I think an attempt to explain how his thinking lays bare the roots of the culture of death in much of the philosophic thought of the last 400 or 500 years.
You've taken us back to John Locke and Thomas Hobbes and a number of other philosophical thinkers who really had a tremendous influence on the thought that would lead us down a very slippery slope, dare I say, the 19th into the 20th century.
You can see the roots of the culture of death in Hobbes very clearly. Just to summarize the teaching of Evangelium Vitae, the Pope says the culture of death is more than just the specific abuses like abortion and euthanasia, but is this culture of thought that makes them seem permissible. And that culture is characterized by individualism, hedonism, utilitarianism, moral relativism. All that's very clearly laid out in the thought of Hobbes, who is, by many people, including me, taken to be sort of the initiator of, or the founder in some ways, of modern liberalism because of its focus on self-interested individuals and their desires and organizing politics around those ideas rather than around, as the Pope would have us do, sort of the transcendent dignity of the human person created in the image and likeness of God.
Now give us one more time the timeline of Thomas Hobbes' life.
Yeah, Hobbes was active in the 1600s. He was a young man when Shakespeare was writing his plays, and he was, I think, influenced by the civil wars that England suffered, which led him to be a proponent of absolute monarchy, absolute unlimited government power. And this is, in fact, I think, what leads to the theoretical mistakes that open his teaching to all the worst abuses of the culture of death. Evangelium Vitae, the Pope suggests that the ultimate fruit of the culture of death is tyranny, because it destroys the dignity of the human person and puts you in a position in which there will be no way of understanding why the powerful shouldn't simply subordinate the powerless. In my book, I argue that Hobbes's teaching pretty clearly has an openness to that same kind of tyranny in the first place because of his moral relativism. Hobbes won't even use the word tyranny, except to debunk it. He says that, you know, words are of inconstant signification, especially moral words, meaning they just mean whatever the speaker wants them to mean. So he says tyranny is not really a form of government, as, say, Aristotle in the Catholic tradition would say it is. It's a form of government where the ruler rules for his own self-interest, not for the common good. Hobbes says it's not really a form of government, it's just monarchy misliked, meaning people don't like their monarch, they call him a tyrant. Well, that's the first step in moral disarmament, it seems to me. If you can't call a tyranny by its proper name, you can't resist it. But then also in his thought, this relativism lays the groundwork, I think, for tyranny, because Hobbes suggests, as we mentioned before, that human beings by nature are in a situation where there is no moral law, they're under no moral obligations, and they create this sovereign power of government to get out of that bad situation. But he's very insistent that there's no moral rules that obtain between the government and the people. The government's free to do whatever it thinks is necessary to secure peace. Once you admit that, then nothing the government does can be wrong. Hobbes is very explicit and says, you know, what are bad laws? And there might be bad laws in the sense of ill-considered laws, but he says there's no such thing as unjust law because law is itself the measure of justice. Once you say something like that, you've legitimized every form of government, no matter how bad it might be. And so there's, I think, this opening to tyranny very clear in Hobbes that the Pope warns about in relation to the culture of death.
an absolute monarchy mm-hmm. would have been very appealing in Elizabethan England, I would think.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and there may be ways in which his teaching resonates with the demands of the time. Although he became controversial later on, certainly we'll talk about Locke, and Locke is a critic of Hobbes in some ways, although I think he buys into the fundamental Hobbesian teaching on a deeper level.
When we talk about a monarchy, there's the presupposition that it is ordained by a higher authority,
mm-hmm.
i.e. God. Would Thomas Hobbes be considered one who believed in that higher authority? Or, I mean, how would mm-hmm. he justify who was selected for the monarchy then?
Yes, that's a very good question. I think Hobbes is pretty clearly a teacher of secular monarchy. He advocates it for secular reasons. But at the same time, he did write in a Christian context, and so he had to find ways to harmonize his teaching with the popularly understood Christian revelation. I say his teaching is secular because the argument is made simply on the basis of the need for peace. And he mm-hmm. says there's kind of two strands to the argument. One is what is absolutely required, and the second is what is preferred. What is absolutely required is absolute government or unlimited sovereignty. Hobbes says, however you organize your government, whether that's in the hands of one, a few, or the many, whether it's monarchical, aristocratic, or democratic, in other words, it has to have unlimited power. If it doesn't have unlimited power, there are kind of chinks in the armor that will lead you back to civil war and chaos, and all the evil of human nature will manifest itself again to everybody's harm. The second part of the argument is, though, that he prefers monarchy. He says, for various kinds of prudential reasons, he thinks monarchy is the government best suited to protect the peace. He makes arguments like, well, you can have factional conflict in a democracy. Some people might actually prefer their own good to the common good. But in a monarchy, it's not as likely to happen because the monarch ruling for life and having all the power, he has a very good incentive to take good care of the country. So, yeah, all that's based upon simply human calculation of human interests, and therefore does kind of depart, I think, from the older traditions of divine right monarchy, of which Hobbes, by the way, is very critical. It's also worth pointing out, just as an aside, for those who are maybe interested in older Catholic political thought, Locke is very critical later on of divine right monarchy, and in at least one passage he tends to, I think, confuse it with absolute monarchy. It's interesting to note in Hobbes that Hobbes is a defender of not divine right monarchy, but absolute monarchy. And I think the earlier defenders of divine right monarchy never defended absolute monarchy, right? I mean, the Christian defenders of the rule of a king as somehow willed by God always understood that God's law and God's will was a kind of superior standard to the monarch, so that the idea that you were ordained, well, look at it this way. One could say on an old-fashioned notion that the father is ordained to rule over the children, but nobody ever thought fathers had unlimited absolute power over their children to destroy them or to use them up however they wanted. I think that goes true for the older-fashioned notion of divine right monarchy, too. It's not the same thing as absolute monarchy. In fact, I think Edmund Burke and other later thinkers who are somewhat more sympathetic to our tradition point that out as well. Now, one final comment on that, not to go on too long, but Hobbes believes in absolute government power. It means it can't be divided. It creates weaknesses in the government authority if it's divided. That's why he would reject things like America's scheme of separation of powers. But since you mentioned religion and the idea of divine right and the relationship of monarchy to religion, he also dispenses with any distinction between what he calls the ghostly and the temporal power, or the spiritual and the temporal power. As far as you're concerned, the king is God's representative. And that's why for Hobbes there can never really be any conflict between religion and politics, because the way he has it arranged, the sovereign will tell you what to think about God and what he demands of you. Because again, Hobbes worries that if people have an independent attachment to God, they might decide that they have to disobey the sovereign or the ruler. Yeah.
What ends up happening, if you do not have a divine right monarchy, mm-hmm. then you have this absolute monarchy, which is i.e. dictatorship, essentially, isn't it? Because mm-hmm. you come into power by virtue of a political play,
mm-hmm.
as opposed to that you have been ordained, essentially,
mm-hmm. yeah.
By birth, to fill this role by God. If God is indeed in charge, you know, under the divine right monarchy, then his representative, i.e. the church, at that time would trump the mm-hmm. divine right monarch.
Right.
So we want to get rid of the divine right monarch because we don't want to have anything to do with the church. So we hoist up the absolute monarchy, i.e. dictatorship.
Yeah.
And we've legitimized dictatorship.
Yeah. And I think one thing that Hobbes and John Locke later have in common is they don't want any institutions in the society that can claim a kind of ultimate allegiance other than the state. Even though, again, John Locke is a critic of Hobbes in arguing for limited government, he does say that the supreme authority in any society is the legislative power, and there can be no higher obedience to any other kind of institution here or in any other country, kind of an indirect reference to Catholics who, as he says in other writings, put their or place some allegiance in a foreign prince like the Pope. Even in the later liberal thinkers who believe in limited government, there is an effort to shunt aside any kind of religious authority that might limit the state, and so they might have a kind of tendency to head in an absolutistic direction even if they don't want to. And I think it's fair to say dictatorship too in Hobbes's case, because even though a king might establish rules for succession and they might hold, still Hobbes says, like when he talks about the powers of the sovereign, he says include the power to punish wrongdoers according to precedent law, or, if there be no such law, according to his judgment for the common good. I'm paraphrasing. But the point there is, that's dictatorship, because you don't have to punish people according to law. You can also punish them according to your own judgment as the sovereign that what they have done is harmful to the common good. That's not the rule of law. That's rule by dictate or decree.
Mm-hmm. So I think it's just important that it has its proper definitions, that we understand when we talk about absolute monarchy, because on the surface, we don't see how does that ultimately begin to unfold in the centuries to come,
right?
Whether you're Napoleon taking over France,
and
or if you're Stalin taking over Russia,
right? Or if you're America in the throes of the culture of death, I would say, because one element in Hobbes's teaching that clearly presages what John Paul II complains about in the modern world is this idea that if the sovereign authority decides it, then it must be just, right? That's clear in Hobbes. If the sovereign says you may do such and such, then you may do it. Well, one of the arguments the Pope takes issue with that are part of this culture of death is the idea that, well, if abortion's legitimized by the majority or by whatever authoritative institution like the Supreme Court, then it must be okay, right? And that's a perfectly Hobbesian argument that has been translated into this contemporary situation. And I think it's fair to attribute that influence to Hobbes, because such an argument would be totally unheard of in the older kind of Catholic and Aristotelian tradition that the Pope draws on, where everybody understood that there is a higher law that the law of society has to respect and conform to. And therefore, there are things that even a legitimate government can do that are illegitimate because they're contrary to the moral law.
I.e. slavery in the 1800s in America.
Yeah. Very hard to make sense of that as a moral question if you adopt Hobbes's teaching or the thought of the culture of death as the Pope describes it.
Right. How do we get to John Locke?
Well, Locke is a follower of Hobbes, and as I argue in the book, he is on the surface a more wholesome follower, because his teaching is not so obviously correlated to what the Pope criticizes as the culture of death. There's some similarities to Hobbes in that they both begin from the so-called state of nature, this idea that human beings by nature don't live under any political authority, but political authority has to be created. The difference, and the thing that makes Locke better, I think, from John Paul II's standpoint, is that Locke says in the state of nature there's no political authority, but there is a law of nature that is the law of reason and is really God's law. And kind of the quick version of the law of nature is that everybody has to try to preserve himself, which Hobbes agrees with too. But then Locke adds everybody's obliged to try to preserve everybody else to the extent that everybody else's preservation doesn't come into competition with yours, you know? So there's an obligation not to, let's say, arbitrarily destroy human life and to try to preserve it to the extent that you can. And Locke, again, in a way that I think would be welcome to the Pope, expressly connects that to the idea that there's a creator, a God, who really is the owner of all human beings. He says, you know, human beings are the property of their creator and they're not to be destroyed by each other because God put us here to be about his business for the duration that he intends, not the duration that we intend. It's a very important qualification in his account of this state of nature, that the state of nature, which is where human beings are by nature, there's no politics, no rules, but there is this natural law, and human beings know that they can't just do whatever they want.
This idea of, dare I say it, divine providence, would that be Locke's essential mode of thought, that he believes in divine providence?
Well, I don't, you know, I'm not so sure about that. He at least believes in divine legislation, let's say. Because I say that, I'm not an expert on every phase of Locke's thought, but in the works I'm drawing on, the first and second treatises, he rarely, if ever, that I can remember, talks about God as sort of exercising direct government over human affairs. I mean, I guess maybe it depends on what you mean by providence. If it means God intervening in human affairs to vindicate justice, there's not so much of that, but there's this appeal to our conscience and our sense that we know that there is a God, and he doesn't want us destroying each other. But at least that is a more robust role for religion in his thought than in Hobbes. You know, I mean, you get the impression from Hobbes that he thinks religion is primarily a problem. It's not something he can ignore because it's just a brute fact of the culture for which he has to write. But he does everything he can to subordinate it and render it harmless, it seems to me. Mm-hmm. Whereas Locke seems to see, wait, there's something useful here. You know, if people believe in... Now, I don't think that Locke is a... I mean, this is controversial. Some people defend Locke as a Christian. I don't really see him as being a thoroughgoing Christian in the way that, you know, like say that John Paul II would approve. But at least he's open to the idea that, well, there's something good to be had from Christianity because people have this residual belief that God created human beings, and that's kind of an undergirding or a support for belief in rights, you know, mm-hmm. Which is what he wants to defend.
Yeah, the reason I ask is that there can be a difference, couldn't there, in that thought that there is the divine creator who is at a distance, mm-hmm. who sets everything into motion, mm-hmm. but not necessarily the same type of relationship with God that most Christians have, of an interpersonal mm-hmm. type of relationship that's affected by our actions and mm-hmm. our response in love or lack of love mm-hmm. towards either to God or to our brothers and sisters.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good point. And that is a way in which Locke is better than Hobbes, I think. Because Hobbes also talks about God as the first cause of all things. When he talks about God, on the one hand, he talks about, you know, myths that people make up about the gods in plural. But then he talks about, well, there's reason can attain to knowledge of the first cause. But yeah, there's nothing in Hobbes's thought to make you think that first cause cares about human beings or has any particular moral teaching or anything like that. And that's a very distant God. We don't even really know what it is, I think, for Hobbes. But yeah, Locke brings in a God that is a lot closer to human beings because we know certain things. He doesn't want us to destroy each other. And more than that, he wants us to take care of each other to the extent that we can. And I think that's something that Locke is deriving from the Christian culture that he found himself in and is trying to use to his advantage, and to a decent advantage. I mean, Locke's teaching, like I say, on the surface at least, is more wholesome than Hobbes's.
Now, his philosophy comes to fruition in what period in time?
Well, you know, roughly the later half of the 1600s. He's the next generation kind of after Hobbes. And he's very delicate, too, in the way he deals with Thomas Hobbes. I mean, I think you can see the influence in certain other areas that we'll talk about in a little bit. But he's also careful to refer really derisively to Hobbes, because Hobbes was known in his own lifetime as an open atheist, even though it's not clear from his works. I mean, people who knew him thought this about him. And also, I mean, just the whole idea of unlimited government is repugnant to Locke. So I think he wants to do what he can to distance himself from Hobbes's teaching, even while he's sort of adopting other elements of it. And then Locke really becomes the thinker who's most important, or among the two or three most important, for the American founders mm-hmm. In their understanding of the basis of republican government.
What sets him apart then from Hobbes, essentially? Is it his respect for monarchy, or lack thereof?
Well, I think the two things are the one we already discussed at the beginning, the idea that there is a law of nature in the state of nature. So there's a law that exists before human beings create law. And what follows from that at the end of their teachings is that because Hobbes rejects that, he says the government is under no law. There's no transcendent law that the government has to respect. Locke says explicitly in more than one place, government must be understood as under the law because there was a law that existed before the government came to exist. And it's this moral law about the preservation of human beings. Or another aspect of that, I guess, is that for Hobbes, as we said before, the power of government's unlimited. And in fact, there is no such thing as tyranny because all governments are always empowered to do anything they want. Locke is very clear in arguing that the power of government has to be understood as being limited. It's limited by this moral law. It's limited by the rights of the individual who consents to government in the first place to protect life, liberty, and estate, right? I mean, mm-hmm. your life, liberty, and your property. And government that's destructive of those ends is tyrannical and deserves to be resisted. You can begin to see there mm-hmm. the connection to the American founders. There's a clear echo of that in the Declaration of Independence. And also that Locke is willing to use the word tyranny. Tyranny is government that goes beyond the proper limits.
Now, what makes John Locke so interesting in this discussion is that on the surface, that seems like all good things, mm-hmm. that this would be right in line with mm-hmm. Catholic social teaching. But there is a bend in the road, isn't there?
There is, and that's the second half of the chapter in which I discuss Locke. And here's what I say. It seems to me that Locke brings in God and God's law and a kind of minimalized version of it, like don't destroy each other, do what you can to preserve each other, as long as it doesn't lead to your own destruction. He brings that in as kind of a decent moral teaching to protect rights, the rights that he thinks human beings have by nature. But then, to use the kind of language that the Pope uses, there's a defective anthropology there, meaning a defective or incomplete account of what it means to be a human being. And to go back to the Pope in Evangelium Vitae, he suggests that if human rights and human dignity are really going to be secure, we have to understand the end of human life, or we have to understand the human vocation, or why God put us here, which is ultimately to achieve happiness through respecting the moral law, and ultimately through the gift of self, you know. And there's really no place for that in Locke that I can see. He doesn't really talk much about generous self-sacrifice, because he always wants to come back to the idea, and this is Hobbesian, this is characteristic of Hobbes, that self-interest is the most powerful force in human nature. That's what I mean by saying that Locke has what the Pope would regard as a defective anthropology, a defective account of human nature. He comes back again and again to this idea that, well, the most powerful passion in human beings is their desire for self-preservation. And that ultimately qualifies this moral law. As I've kind of been careful to say the first couple of times I mentioned it, it's mm-hmm. you have a duty to preserve other people as long as your own preservation doesn't come into conflict. And so he talks in general terms about the law of nature is preserve yourself and preserve others. But then when he states the simplest version of what he calls the fundamental, supreme, and sacred law of nature is preserve yourself. As I said before, Hobbes has this kind of rank and obvious individualism. Locke tends to kind of veer back in that same direction. And that tends to undermine the decent law of nature that he establishes in the first place, because as the Pope points out in Evangelium Vitae, if you tell people, okay, we just have to, we have this moral law, but we also tell them at the same time, you're fundamentally an individual who is self-interested, they're going to chafe under the moral law. You know, they're going to feel like, well, the moral law really isn't good for me. It's good for other people if I respect it, but I kind of wish I could get away with getting around it somehow. And I think Locke sets up those same kinds of, you know, probably unintentionally, but he sets up those same kinds of problems in the person who wants to be a full-blown Lockean. You know, they're kind of confronted with this moral, natural law of reason and of God that tells you you have to tell respect other people's rights and even help other people if they need your help. But at the same time, you are, by nature, a fundamentally self-interested being that doesn't care about other people that much. And it turns, to use this language that the Pope uses, it turns the moral law into a heteronomy, right? Some kind of law that's imposed on you from the outside, as opposed to a law that has or corresponds to your own nature. To sum it up, I think, yeah, the Pope would say, human beings become what they are. They fulfill themselves through respecting the moral law and giving themselves. And I don't think there's any basis for that in Locke or in Hobbes.
What happens down the road, a century or so later, would be the advent of, say, Darwinian social thought, mm-hmm. wouldn't it, from what John Locke is saying? Because I will do good to others as long as it doesn't undo the good that's done to me. Mm-hmm. So that self-preservation is a very evolutionary type of thought, mm-hmm. that we're not made up to do self-sacrifice.
Right. Yeah, I think that is a real correspondence between that later trend and what you see in Locke. I mean, there's a kind of morality in Locke. There's a kind of morality that you can get from Darwinism, but it doesn't get very high off the ground, if you know what I mean. Or to make the contrast as clear as possible, maybe, in Veritatis Splendor, John Paul II says, the moral law is holy, and the ultimate witnesses to the holiness of the moral law are the martyrs, who see that there are things that simply must not be done. You know, in certain hard cases, you would sacrifice yourself to the moral law. There are things you would rather never do, and you'd rather die than do. And that never comes up in Locke, because the fundamental principle is self-preservation. Mm-hmm. And that leads to a lot of problems in his thought, I think, including an openness. Well, it leads to a diminishment of our respect for human life, because it kind of lends itself to the utilitarian calculation by which the Pope says the culture of death tends to degrade human life that's not very productive, right?
Mm-hmm.
Locke's human beings are concerned with comfortable self-preservation. They want to live, and they want to live well. And if you come upon other human beings who don't contribute much to that, you'll be inclined to think that, well, they're really not that valuable. Whereas for the Pope, they have an intrinsic value, rather, that comes from having been created in the image and likeness of God. It also creates certain openings to tyranny, I think, even in Locke. Even though Locke, in his basic teaching, is opposed to tyranny, opposed to the idea of unlimited government, this kind of selfish or self-interested account of human nature undermines the basis on which people would resist tyranny, I think. In other words, if you're a Lockean human being and you live under a tyrannical government, I mean, what would be your obligation to resist it? There really wouldn't be any unless it was directly attacking you, you know?
Right.
If it were, then your self-interested or your interest in self-preservation would come into play. But if it's attacking other people, it seems to me that Locke counsels, well, just leave it alone. Because if your own preservation and your own property is not at stake, what happens to other people is not really your own concern.
Well, and this is why this is important for us today, because what we can learn from history is that by accepting 80% of a thought that's good,
mm-hmm.
the 20% that's not good leaves the door wide open for all kinds of things to creep in.
Mm-hmm.
And an acceptance of things that should be unacceptable. For example, that's what happened in the 1800s with slavery, mm-hmm. when the question came up. Because it was in the best interest of the country and of the farmers and the plantation owners, mm-hmm. to have slaves.
Yeah.
And so the country somehow justified using that type of thought, essentially,
mm-hmm.
the fact that man, an African-American male or female, are three-fifths human, that we could take away mm-hmm. their dignity in order to preserve the economy, the interests of mm-hmm. those who needed to have their labor.
Yeah.
And so 80% of Locke was good, but potentially 20% of problematic thought yeah. left a huge door open.
Yeah, I like that formulation too, because it seems to me correct with regard to the Pope. You know, he seems to suggest that we got to get things right. You know, they got to be got completely right, or we're going to get into trouble. You know, we have to understand human beings in the fullness of what it means to be human, and not just get it mostly right.
Because
mm-hmm. if you say, like Locke, that human beings seek their own self-preservation, and if you say that they have a right to seek their own self-preservation, you've said something true, you just haven't said the whole truth about human beings. And as we know, I mean, a partial truth is sometimes a lie, you know?
That's right.
And in fact, it would be impossible probably for any political philosopher or anybody anywhere to tell a complete lie about human beings, because nobody is so constituted as to get it that far wrong. Nobody could pull the wool over your eyes that much if they wanted to just tell you the exact opposite about human nature than what was true. But we know by experience that plenty of problems can come from just getting the answer imperfectly correct. And in my book, I talk about a Lockean opening to tyranny, or an opening to tyranny in Locke's thought, such as we just discussed. But I'm not the first person to do that. There are other earlier students of Locke who have noticed that, yeah, there's an opening to slavery in Locke's teaching that may have been partly responsible for the experience of slavery in America, for the kind of along the reasons you just articulated, that if human beings are fundamentally self-interested, then they can sometimes find themselves in situations where it seems like my self-interest depends upon enslaving somebody else. And I mean, that may be especially true of like later generations of a slaveholding society, like at the time of the founding, who weren't sure how they could free their slaves without endangering themselves. You know, I mean, these guys mm-hmm. were worried about race war and stuff like that because they'd already done so much injustice to the Africans. They worried about letting them go. You know, like Thomas Jefferson said in a famous phrase, slavery is like holding a wolf by the ears. You know, you don't mm-hmm. really want to do it, but you don't want to let go either. But if you push the argument or the logic even further, you could think, well, what about actually initiating slavery? You know, if you think that it's in your self-interest, if it's necessary to preserving you and to preserving your comfortable self-preservation, you would certainly be tempted to do it. I mean, there are these other strands in Locke that say, don't do it, right?
Mm-hmm.
So we can't ignore that. I don't want to be unfair to him. But on the other hand, by teaching people that really two things, that human beings are fundamentally self-interested, and also by suggesting, as he does in the second treatise and the first treatise of civil government, that the moral law is derived from the passions, he's kind of inviting people to consider deriving new moral laws from new passions when they think that they can get they need to do an injustice and think they can get away with it.
Interesting train of thought. gosh, takes us down into a very dark area, I think. But this is all the time we have for right now. I look forward to continuing our thought. Thank you so much, Dr. Carson Holloway.
Thanks very much for having me.
You've been listening to The Way of Life, Reflections on the Teachings of St. John Paul II with Dr. Carson Holloway. To hear and or to download this discussion along with many others, go to discerninghearts.com. This has been a production of discerninghearts.com. I'm your host, Chris McGregor. Join us next time for The Way of Life, Reflections on the Teachings of St. John Paul II with Dr. Carson Holloway.